From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Computer scientist Kentaro Toriyama is a professor at the University of Michigan School of Information and co-founder of Microsoft Research India. So you might expect him to be a fervent proselytizer for the wonders of technology. But Toriyama has written a somewhat heretical treatise called, appropriately, Geek Heresy, Rescuing Social Change from the Cult of Technology, in which he argues that technology not only fails as a solution, but distracts us from the causes of genuine progress.
Kentaro, good to have you on this program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
We had a conversation some months on this program ago with Peter Diamandis, who had a totally different view of this particular issue. Let me just start by saying that there are not many people, at least to my mind, who are willing to go on the record, much less with a text, challenging technology, particularly
a computer
technologist.
No, I think you're right. I think overall in society, we're living in an age in which we believe that technology is a terrific thing, wonderful thing, and it certainly has impacted all of our lives. Mm-hmm. But there's also a mythology that surrounds it that isn't entirely accurate, that it kind of causes social progress in and of itself.
Mm-hmm. What most troubles you, we'll get to some of these myths in a second, but what most troubles you about our worshiping at the altar of technology?
I mean, I think worshiping is the right book. I mean, the right word. That's why I say it's a heresy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that we are basically being distracted by these incredible technologies as a way to cause social change. And because they don't actually work, we are using, you know, resources and efforts that might otherwise go to actual, you know, use, to actual value. And instead, we're trying to build more technologies to solve our social problems.
Yep. I want to make the most of my time that I have with you, which is limited, and I want to spend our time talking about three or four of these myths that you really try to unpack or take on in the text. In no particular order, the notion that technology is always a time saver.
Right, absolutely, or even a cost saver.
Yeah,
absolutely. You know, we hear about companies like Walmart who use all kinds of digital technology to streamline their processes, and of course they get their costs down very low. But that's because Walmart is already a company that is so focused on cost cutting that when they import technologies, you know, they are able to cut further costs. But in a lot of our systems, the underlying social structures, our institutions, are not focused on cost cutting. So when they import more technologies, things actually going the other way. So one example of that is the U.S. healthcare system. You know, we spend more than just about every other developed world country on healthcare per person. Mm-hmm. And yet we don't get the value out of that because our incentives are not structured right, our larger political goals are not aligned. And so in that culture, you know, even if we import more technology, costs just keep going up and up.
Given all of the political debate of late and certainly the Supreme Court decision about Obamacare, do you expect that's going to get better or worse with this new law?
Well, I think that Obamacare is probably going in the right direction in the sense that it means that more of us will have health insurance, and that's terrific. And that's exactly the kind of political change we need. As long as that political infrastructure is there, then certainly the technology could end up helping. The one thing that I say about technology is that it amplifies underlying human forces. So when those human forces are positive and they're acting in the right way, then technology will help. But wherever those forces are either negative or indifferent, then it doesn't make a difference how much technology you have.
The other myth you take on in the text is that big data makes big problems transparent.
Yeah, these days, you know, we hear a lot about big data and how it makes it easier and easier for organizations to make the right kind of decisions. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there are so many things in the world where the things that matter can't be quantified, can't be counted, mm-hmm. and that's going to be true forever. You know, even if we have all the technology in the world, there are always going to be some things that are really valuable to us, you know, like freedom or justice, that are not going to be easy to put numbers to. And as long as that's true, what that means is, you know, we need something to counteract big data, which I think of as big wisdom. You know, we need more, we need better judgment, better discernment about our decision making. Not that measurement is bad, but that it needs to be balanced with more qualitative judgment.
Yeah. When I saw this next myth, this is the piece of the text that I wanted to run to fastest because I really wanted to hear and read how you were going to unpack this argument, which is this notion that social media brings people together. You don't believe that necessarily.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you think about it, just here in the United States, right, we've never been as connected via social media as we are now. And yet, you know, politically, we seem to be even more polarized than ever. You know, some scholars have a word for this, which is cyber balkanization, and it basically means that, you know, everybody tends to watch the news and hang out online with the people that they most agree with already. And so, if anything, we're not hearing the other opinions. We're not able to empathize with the other side. You know, once upon a time in America, we used to only have four television channels, right? And at that time, you know, everybody tuned into Walter Cronkite, and he was giving the same editorial for everybody. So at least we heard, you know, the same side of the story. Today, we increasingly go either to, let's say, Fox News or MSNBC, depending on how your politics goes. And, you know, what that means is we're not hearing the other side.
What about the fact that social media has been used in places like, say, Egypt, Tunisia, to, in fact, bring people, Iran, for that matter, to, in fact, bring people together to fight for worthy causes, least of all, I shouldn't say least of all, but certainly on that list, democracy.
Right. So people talk about the Facebook revolution and the Arab Spring. And, you know, what I always say is that if we're going to call those revolutions a Facebook revolution, we should be willing to call the American Revolution a lantern revolution because of Paul Revere and one if by land, two if by sea. You know, basically, revolutionaries use whatever communication tools at their disposal. And it just so happens in our generation, that happens to be Facebook, Twitter, and what have you. But that doesn't mean that the technology is causing the revolution in itself. In fact, in Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, there were actually multiple attempts to kind of start protests, even a, what was called a day of rage, soon after the Egyptian revolution. And none of those protests materialized. I mean, so much so that we didn't hear about it that much in the, you know, mainstream media. And that's because in those countries, there's not much of existing civil society for the technology to amplify. Whereas in Egypt, there was the Muslim Brotherhood, there were labor unions, there were trade unions, there were, you know, student groups and so on. And those organizations actually went door to door to, you know, start the kickstart the protests. And if it wasn't for that, I don't think there would have been much of a Facebook revolution at all.
The other myth I wanted to get to, and so I'm glad you're here to talk about it, is this notion that digital systems, these digital systems level playing fields. And that was a particular interest to me, in part because as an African-American, obviously, you know, we were told that we were going to make, we were going to get ours in the Industrial Revolution. That didn't quite happen.
No, that's true.
Then they said you'll get it during the Technological Revolution. That isn't quite happening.
Exactly.
I mean, certainly people of color, many of us are consumers, but we're not producers.
Right.
So this notion that digital systems automatically level playing fields is one that I want you to kind of unpack a little bit.
No, I think those are exactly the right questions to ask. You know, one of the challenges with these things is that just because everybody has access to the same technology doesn't mean that they get the same value out of it. And so, you know, even if we were able to get rid of what's called the digital divide, you know, this idea that everyone doesn't have equal access to the same technologies, even if we were able to get those technologies out to everybody, basically wealthier, more powerful, well-educated people get much more value out of the same technology than those who don't have
those. In what ways?
So, for example, you know, I sometimes ask this question, you know, imagine if you and I competing with, let's say, somebody who's involuntarily homeless, you know, let's say in Detroit, we both had unlimited access of to the internet for 1 week. And, you know, we had some task, like, let's say, raise as much money for the charity of your choice, right? Who would be able to do that better? Well, obviously, you or me, because we have, you know, wealthier friends. We know how to use these tools. You know, we know how to organize people and things like that. In fact, exactly the things that allow us to be productive also mean that, you know, we have good jobs. Whereas exactly those reasons why, you know, somebody who's, let's say, homeless in the inner city can't get a good job are the same reasons why they won't be able to take advantage of the same internet. You can flip that around. You know, we can ask questions about whether Bill Clinton or Bill Gates would do better than us online. And it's the same thing. They would do much better. And it's exactly because they have even wealthier friends and even better social connections, even more political influence.
So it's almost like a red herring then, because one of the arguments people make all the time when they defend, and even my friend Peter Diamandis made this point, that, you know, when you're at your computer and Bill Gates is at his computer, you have access to the same information Bill Gates has access to.
That's true, but when Bill Gates sends an email to, say, President Obama, there's a good chance he'll get a response. Whereas if I send that same email, that's not going to happen.
Yeah. What do you mean when you say the cult of technology? That's a strong... It's a strong phrase.
Yeah, so I think it's like a religion in that it's kind of, you know, it has a hold on us at a, you know, deep intellectual level. You know, especially those of us who are well-educated, we kind of live in our little bubble of a world in which, you know, we have our smartphones, we Google responses to everything. You know, we can get a book delivered by us through Amazon or even on our Kindles in an instant. But that's not the situation for the rest of the world. In fact, it's not the situation for the majority of the world. You know, if you don't have the education, the social ties, the political influence to be able to move people and to, you know, work in the knowledge economy, then a lot of these tools are, you know, virtually, you know, useless, at least in terms of getting a better job.
Yep. I should mention, I've mentioned Peter Diamandis' name a couple of times. You can go to our website, Tavis Smiley Show. Peter Diamandis was the founder of the X Prize. So if you want to hear our conversation with him, his take on this, which is quite different, you should just go to our website. Finally, very quickly here, I wonder whether or not there are countries that are doing better on this issue than we are here in the U.S. That is to say, using technology for greater, more noble purposes.
That's a great question. You know, what I always say again is that technology amplifies underlying human forces. Mm-hmm. So in a strange way, that means in order to make better use of technology, you actually want to look at those places that have better, you know, politics, better social support, better, a stronger culture of supporting everybody in those countries. And I actually think those countries exist right now. They often happen to be, you know, Northern European, Scandinavian countries, mm-hmm. where they have excellent, you know, support for everybody in the country, not just the elite. Great education is provided for everybody. You know, the government supports things like, you know, trying to work towards a more sustainable future. And exactly in those places, because the policies and because the culture is going in the right direction, the technology also mm-hmm. supports those things.
I lied. I have one final question, which is, this is such a fascinating conversation, which is, what advice you would give beyond reading the book, Geek Heresy, what advice you would give to those of us who live and work in this country about how we better use our agency to use the technology at our fingertips to advance the kind of social change, to imagine the kind of country that we really want to live in?
Right. I would say two things. First is, you know, if you're going to use technology, you should use it to amplify positive efforts. So mm-hmm. we should look for organizations that we think are doing the right thing and help them do those, you know, their work better through technology. But if you're free to do things without technology, and I think all of us are, mm-hmm. you know, even computer scientists like me, then I think we have to work much harder on the political, social, cultural, economic forces. Because, again, in a world where we have abundant technology, the technology kind of takes care of itself. What we really need to work on is that social foundation. And when that's right, then the technology does the right thing as well.
His name is Kentaro Toyama. His book is called Geek Heresy, Rescuing Social Change from the Cult of Technology. Highly recommended, a fine read. Kentaro, good to have you on the program. Thanks for your insights.
Thank you.
Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. More than 30 years ago, a local radio station in New York risked airing a 15-minute program featuring Dr. Ruth Westheimer, a middle-aged sex therapist with a high-pitched voice and a heavy German accent. It didn't take long for her to catch on. Everyone was talking about Dr. Ruth and her frank but good-humored advice. She recently celebrated her 87th birthday with a new text.
The doctor is in. Dr. Ruth on Love, Life, and Joie de Vivre. I can never say that right.
You say it almost right. Joie de vivre.
You say it better.
Joie de vivre. Now we pluck the book. Very good.
Okay. The book coincides with her 87th birthday. It's part memoir, part life manual. So I am pleased to have her back on this program. How are you?
I am very good, and I'm lucky that I knew how tall you were. Yeah. So I right away asked for pillows.
Some pillows.
I can look you straight into the eyes.
87, you show no slowdown. You're not slowing down.
Never.
Yeah.
Never. I'm going to rewire, not to retire.
Yeah.
Sherry Lansing coined that term.
Yeah.
To rewire.
Rewire, not retire.
Not retire.
Yeah.
So everybody should hear that. And that's a little bit why I did the book.
Yeah.
To show a little bit about my philosophy of life. Despite the fact that I was an orphan, as you know,
yeah.
at the age of 10.
Mm-hmm.
If the Americans, you had not entered, no, you are too young, but
yeah.
your parents,
yeah.
if they had not entered World War II, I wouldn't be alive, because Hitler would have taken Switzerland.
Yeah.
And then I was in the Haganah. Watch out, Tavis, I know how to shoot.
Yeah, I know, you were a sniper.
I was a sniper, 5 bullets into the red circle. But I only do that with people who don't plug the book. The Amazon people are very happy with me. But what I wanted to show in a serious way is, despite the fact that everybody has problems, everybody has something in their lives that kind of makes them sad, be sad for a little while and then go on to something that makes you happy. Mm. Watching Tavis Smiley, for example.
Oh, yeah.
Do something where you learn something, where your brain is working, and where you have some conversation. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm very happy to be on your show again.
But how did you find your way to happiness, given all that you had to go through, being an orphan, et cetera, et cetera?
Very important question.
Yeah.
I believe that the early socialization of a child, the first years, are crucial. I was in a household in Frankfurt am Main with parents, with a grandmother who had nothing else to do but take care of me, another set of grandparents on the farm. I went to a very good school. I had those very early years of my childhood in a loving Jewish Orthodox environment that gave me the strength to withstand the sad things that happened later. Like parents killed in concentration camp, my whole family disappeared. I was an only child. And that's why I did the book, by showing everybody has something that it could kind of make them sit home and be sad.
Mm-hmm.
A divorce, some sickness. And I'm saying, yes, do mourn. I had mourned my late husband.
Mm-hmm.
But then afterwards, do something positive. Participate in life. I go to a lot of shows. I go to a lot of fundraisers.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very lucky. I'm 87 and healthy. I can dance a whole night if I find somebody to dance with. But you are too tall. I need somebody a little shorter.
Yeah.
And you are too young. So that's what I mean also in the Talmud, in the Jewish tradition, it says, a lesson taught with humor is a lesson retained.
Mm.
You do remember some professors of yours, not jokes, but who could use humor, and you remembered what they said.
Yeah.
So I want people to know, with all of the things that have happened to me, to keep a positive attitude, to come out to Los Angeles, to do Tavis Smiley Show, to do something, to tell you, this is not my last book. I'm coming back again next year.
I believe you, and you're welcome anytime. What's amazing to me, beyond the fact, Dr. Ruth, beyond the fact that you wake up every day trying to be better and not bitter, there's so much to be bitter about in your life.
Ooh,
if you
like
want
that.
It to be.
Wait, say that again.
You work.
You
wake up every day to be
and
better.
Not bitter.
Not
I like
bitter.
That.
Yeah, you do that every day, and I see that in the work that you do. That's amazing to me. What's even more amazing to me, though, is that given what happened to your parents and all the evil that you saw, that you still have a fundamental belief in the goodness of people.
I do.
Why?
I tell you what. I go to Germany.
Yeah.
I'm now going to Germany. You could come with me in October for the book fair.
I love Germany. What city do you want to?
Frankfurt.
Oh, I love it.
To plug the book,
yes.
Which is coming out in German.
Yeah.
But you see, it's sad for me because that's where I grew up.
Yeah.
So I see the railroad station. And I don't go near, because that's the last time I saw my mother and grandmother. My father had already been taken to a labor camp.
Mm.
So I don't forget the past. You can't forget the past. And you can't forget history. But I have no hard feelings about people my age, because I was 10 years old. And I have no problems with young people. I gave a lecture at the University of Heidelberg.
Mm-hmm.
Because young people are not responsible for what their grandparents did. Not easy for me to go, but I go because if I do the book and if they have gold lettering on the spine, I have an obligation to sell it. But you don't have to buy it. You're getting it.
I got my copy. I'm glad. How did you end up in this particular lane of all the things that you could have done? Obviously, you're such a people person, and you have such great skills with people. Why sex therapy? How did that happen for you?
Okay, how that happened?
Yeah.
I was working in public health.
Right.
I thought that's what I'll do. Fortunately for me, the money ran out on a government project. I needed a job.
Yeah.
I got a position in research for Planned Parenthood of New York City.
Mm-hmm.
I took it. And I came home and I told my late husband, Fred, I said, Fred, something is wrong with these people. All they do is talk about sex. They don't talk about philosophy. They don't talk about the weather. They don't talk about food, nothing, just sex. 48 hours later, I said, hold it. What an interesting subject matter. And I did my doctoral dissertation, Columbia University, where I teach now, mm-hmm. on that subject of training paraprofessionals to be family planning counselors. Then I realized I did not know enough. People used to whisper me questions. He had a problem getting it up. You know what I mean. I'm careful on your program.
Yes.
She had a problem having sexual satisfaction. Mm-hmm. I said, I need further training. And I went for 7 years to Cornell Medical Center, mm-hmm. being trained by a wonderful trainer, Dr. Helen Singer Kaplan, twice a week. And then I really became a sex therapist. And a sex I see myself really as an educator.
Yeah.
And but it's very nice to talk about sex all day long. Look at me, 87 years old, I still talk about sex.
When you first started on the radio late at night, 15 minutes.
WYNY.
WYNY. Give me some sense of how skittish people were then, how scared they were about you talking about sex on the radio late at night, and how things have changed over the years.
I did it 10 years.
Yeah.
Every Sunday night.
Yeah.
First, there were people in suits like you, tie and suits, attorneys, watching. A couple of weeks later, they disappeared.
Yeah.
Well, I was very fortunate. I asked for questions. People called in. I never said, give me your name.
Yeah.
I said, Tavis, say a friend of mine has a problem. Mm-hmm. And I tell you what, for 10 years, I provided people a little older than you with a tremendous amount of foreplay. They got into their car at 10 o'clock. By 12 o'clock, they were home. They were nicely sexually aroused because of my talking. So it happened because I took the risk to make a presentation to broadcasters.
Yeah.
I said, we in this country have the best scientifically validated data about human sexual functioning. Mm-hmm. You broadcasters have the power of the airwaves. You ought to have a program. I didn't think I would do the program.
Yeah.
Listen to my accent. I thought I'd be a consultant to somebody who would do it.
Yeah.
And look what happened. 10 years I did that, 450 television shows, and I'm still talking about sex from morning to now, even on the Tavis show.
What have you learned that you share in the book? Mm-hmm. About the joy. We know the difficulties, the challenges, the joys of getting older. Mm-hmm.
The first thing I learned is that's from Sherry Lansing, mm-hmm. who said not to retire, but mm-hmm. to rewire.
Right.
But there's more to that. I learned that you have to be, you too, you have to be like a turtle. A turtle has its house on its back, mm-hmm. safe. Nothing can happen to it. Mm. If that turtle wants to move, if it wants to do something new, if it wants to do a television show like you, it has to take a risk. Mm. It has to stick its neck out.
Yeah.
It could get hurt.
That's right.
But without sticking its neck out, it doesn't move. I have learned that you have to take a risk to stand up, be counted, in order to make this world a better world. And I tell you something else. Since I was an orphan, didn't have any family, it's more, even more important for me to make a dent in society. Mm. I need to do something, and I'm doing it by talking about sex, that is going to change people's lives. Mm. I like your serious face.
Yeah, because you make me think. Every time I talk to you, you're always making me think. You were married for how many years before Fred passed?
Fred, I was married almost 40 years.
40 years, yeah.
You even know Fred's name. I like that.
Oh, yeah.
Now, Fred had a very bad stroke.
Yeah.
He wouldn't have wanted to live because his brain was gone.
Yeah.
And I'm fortunate. I have a daughter. I have a son.
Yeah.
I have four fantastic grandchildren.
Yeah.
And you will understand, Tavis, when I talk about them, Hitler lost and I won.
Oh.
Because I have four grandchildren and I'm here and he is gone. So I have that combination of not forgetting where I came from. I have to tell you something funny. I talk about that also in the book. There's a play about me called Becoming Dr. Ruth.
Mm, I've seen it.
You did?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Saw it in New York,
Deborah Jo Rapp mm-hmm. had to take a speech therapist mm-hmm. to learn my accent.
Mm-hmm.
When I came to this country, they said, you want to teach here? You have to take a speech teacher to lose your accent. Thank God I never did that. I never had the money. I made $1 an hour. Who could pay for a speech person? Deborah Jo Rapp had to take a speech therapist.
To learn your accent.
To play learn my accent.
To play you on stage.
To play me on stage. It's now going to have an opening in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
If you are nearby, I want to invite you.
Yeah.
You saw it?
Yeah.
You didn't tell me?
No, I just...
I would have taken you for dinner before or after.
Well, I'll hold you to
I can't go dancing with you because you're too tall.
I'll get on my knees.
You're too young.
I'll dance on my knees. tell me very quickly what you, all those years with Fred, what you learned about love.
Mm-hmm.
About love. Tell me something about love.
Okay. That you can't take it for granted.
Yeah.
You have to work at that relationship every single day. It doesn't matter how. Just pick up the phone, tell your significant other, I love you. Hang up. Send a flower, not just for Valentine's Day. This love has to be cultivated. It has to be worked on. It can't be taken for granted. Yeah. Not just because you have had it, that you think that it will go on forever. And if there are problems, take those problems. Make a package. Leave them outside your bedroom door. Don't leave the problems in the bedroom. I promise you, the package will stay there for the next day.
Mm.
Nobody else is going to pick it up. And boredom in the bedroom is the worst thing that can happen. So you have to vary the position. You have to vary the time of day, especially people who are listening to you. Older people have to know to engage in sex in the mornings, not at night when they are tired. There are many issues, and I talk about that because I say you can't take it for granted.
Yeah.
Like you have to rejoice in that joie de vivre, in being alive, and I'm very fortunate.
Yeah.
87, and look how I can jump and dance, but I gave up skiing.
Yeah.
that's the only thing I gave up.
You're
now.
Skiing. You know what? You are welcome here anytime. I so enjoy talking to you.
Thank you.
You come back anytime you want.
Will you call me when you get to New York?
Of course I will call you.
You promise?
I promise. I'll get your number.
I take you.
Yes, we want to eat.
Thank you. Mm. I pay.
No.
Because you are on public television.
Yeah.
I pay. I
love her. The new book from Dr. Ruth is called The Doctor Is In. Dr. Ruth on love, life, and say it again.
Joie de vivre.
I love it.
Thank you.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Rapper Michael Render, better known by his stage name as Killer Mike, kills it both on and off the stage. As one half of the successful duo Run the Jewels, he's become one of hip-hop's most creative voices. Throughout his career, he has used his music as a tool of enlightenment and social change. His influence and his views are so strong that we couldn't cover them adequately in just one part. And so we're bringing you part one of our conversation with Killer Mike today, followed by part two next week. Before we start, though, let's hear an excerpt from one of Killer Mike's most politically charged and thought-provoking songs. It's called Reagan.
They declared the war on drugs, like a war on terror. But what it really did was let the police terrorize whoever. But mostly black boys, but they would call us niggas and lay us on our belly while they fingers on their triggers. They boots was on our head, they dolls was on our crotches. And they would beat us up if we had diamonds on our watches. And they would take our drugs and monies as they pick our pockets. I guess that's the privilege of policing for some profit. But thanks to Reaganomics, prison turned to profits. Cause free labor's the cornerstone of U.S. economics. Cause slavery was a bomb. Unless you are in prison, you think I ambush and then read the 13th Amendment. Involuntary servitude and slavery it prohibits. That's why they giving drug offenders time in double digits. Ronald Reagan was an actor, not at all a factor, just an employee of the country's real master.
Strong stuff, and yet I know you offer no apology.
No apologies to give.
Yeah.
Yeah. No apologies to give for the truth.
Yeah.
Now you might suffer for the truth.
Yeah.
But ain't no apologizing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you suffered for it?
Absolutely.
In what ways?
I mean, I'm an artist that is from the South, and we are known for making hits that are danceable, that are juke, that are jive even. But, you know, everyone doesn't go the route of pop and popular music. And for every pop sensation, you have to have a Nina Simone.
Yeah.
You know, you have to have a Miles. You have to have people who are popular, but they're popular because they took the stand to say, I'm not going to do what's popular. I'm going to do what registers with my soul. And I've always tried to do that. The greatest compliment that I got probably this year, besides Happy Father's Day, was Ice Cube, who I'm a student of and who I've admired for over 20 years. When asked about hip hop and what he loved about it, he mentioned me and said, I love Mike, and he has continually done this type of music. He's unwavering. And that was the best compliment I'd ever got.
That's how I caught me. It comes from him, though.
Yeah, when O'Shea Jackson said that, it means something.
Yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
O'Shea Jackson, that's exactly right. Let me go back. You said a couple of things now. I see it's going to be an interesting show, and I'm so excited to finally have you on this program.
I'm excited to be out. My wife was angry with you.
What? For
what?
Yeah,
black woman mad, boy. My household went cool for too late.
Why?
Because I've been trying to get on this show for like 2 years.
No, we've been
fighting and fussing. And you told the truth. You said, hey, it's just not time yet. And I don't know if it came from you or in the office, but it came. And I walked down that hallway, and I looked at all the prestigious people, and I looked and I stopped when I saw Bill Withers up there.
Yeah.
And I thought about just how noble he is and how honest and truthful and how long it took him to be officially recognized. I said, boy, you need to humble yourself and just be glad. Look, I ain't saying that to my wife, though, but I really am glad to be here.
First of all, let me say to your wife, what's your wife's first name?
Shay.
Shay. Hey, baby. First of all, second of all, we fight like the devil around here to try to make this thing work and get everybody on that we want on. So it was not about, no hate on your baby. We just tried to find the right date, the right time, the right place, and I'm honored to have him on the program.
We have.
Am I out of hot water now?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, she in the back.
Okay. Oh, she's here. Oh, Lord Jesus.
Right, but she, time I told her we got the show, she booked the plane ticket in 15 minutes.
Well,
she was like, we on our
way. I look forward to getting a hug from Shay when this show.
And we watch your show, so thank you.
I appreciate it. No, I appreciate all that. And I appreciate your work and your truth telling.
Absolutely.
Let me go back to something you said a moment ago, which is, the invoking of the name Nina Simone.
Yeah.
Just saw a piece in the New York Times, front page piece in the arts and leisure section, that was trying to unpack what it means that Nina Simone is back.
Yeah.
I mean, decades after her apex, now everybody is talking about Nina Simone.
Yeah.
Documentaries, movies, T-shirts, and everything else. Everybody now is into Simone. What do you make of the fact that sometimes when you are that committed to telling the truth, that it ain't even appreciated until after you're dead?
It drives you, though, you know, because it's a fire that's in you that, like, man, Nina could have made 100 different types of records that are instantly given her. I've seen Janelle Monáe do the exact same thing. I've seen Janelle tell her truth the way she sees it. And unrelentingly, and I'm proud of her for that. I, as an artist, have chosen that high road. But what if we hadn't? You know, what if we would have did something else? The world would have missed an opportunity to rediscover. So as an artist, you like money, you like fame, you like travel, you like those things. But what you really have to understand is that there's something that's in an artist that has to come out. Now, everybody has talent. There are some people who are talented at singing. They can sing, but that don't make them an artist. Mm-hmm. The other people that have a fire burning inside them that they must get out. The only way you can't put it out, you can't stuff it, you can't close it, you can't suffocate it, it has to come out. So truth crushed to the earth gonna rise again.
Mm-hmm.
So with Nina's music, whatever got forgotten now, I mean back then, is rediscovered now.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that she's gone is not the truth, because her music is eternal.
Mm.
Children are going to rediscover her. My 7-year-old runs around the house while Nina Simone plays in the morning. So for me, I say that I hate that a lot of artists, including myself, were overlooked for a lot of times. But when the world is ready, it is best that the music is there. It is best that the paintings is there. Mm. It's best that it's there. You know, Van Gogh never received a dollar and is one of the most celebrated artists ever. And I'm glad that Nina felt some of the love while she was here. And I'm even more happy now that her family understands what her legacy means to the world.
See, that's a beautiful example. I think about that Van Gogh scenario all the time.
Yeah.
Van Gogh never received a dollar.
Never.
And now his stuff is selling for hundreds of millions of dollars.
Absolutely.
All these years later.
Absolutely.
What is the source? I can't ask Nina Simone this question because she ain't here. Yeah. But I can ask it of you, Mike. What is the source for you of that courage, that conviction, that commitment, that character, to tell these kinds of unwavering truths?
I don't know. Maybe if I knew, I could stop.
what do you make of that? Give me your best guess for where that comes from.
Old people raised me.
Yeah.
My grandfather was born in 1922. My grandmother was born in 1932. Mm-hmm. They were 54 and 44 when I was born. They didn't have time to play or BS us. Mm-hmm. They just came to us for real. It came to us straight. So that's kind of the way I learned. Like, my grandmother didn't say, oh, you got bad grades, you're struggling. She said, you're dumb. Mm-hmm. And if you didn't want to get called dumb, mm-hmm. well, Mom, you hurt my feelings, you called me dumb. Well, you brought in dumb people grades. Mm-hmm. You know, my grandfather, when I would ask him, well, Granddad, I'm tired. Why we got to get up and pick bait? Because you got to fish. Well, Grand, why do we have to fish? Because you got to eat. Mm-hmm. Why we have to fish to eat? Because I'm not buying meat this week. I learned the world from a very practical and real standpoint. Mm-hmm. So when I write music, I just try to write from a honest worker class perspective. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I see dignity and nobility in the black working class. Mm-hmm. And I have always tried to express that in ways in my music. Now, my music ain't perfect. I talk about liquor. I talk about all the stuff bluesmen talk about. I was mm-hmm. a kid raised in church that was infatuated with the streets. Mm-hmm. Just like bluesmen grew up singing gospel and mm-hmm. found the blues. Yeah, but there's a dignity in my music, and it's going to be unrelenting until I stop making music, because I see the value in particular in yeah. black people and black men.
Hip hop has a number of, how might I put this? There are variations and iterations and gradations and flavors mm-hmm. of hip hop. You got your East Coast flavor, you got your West Coast flavor. There's a different flavor coming from down south. You mentioned your grandparents. Situate for me growing up in the South vis-a-vis your music.
Well, Southern hip-hop has a morality. Well, hip-hop is the culture. Mm-hmm. Let me say that. Hip-hop is, there's sure. a movie coming out called Rubble Kings. Mm-hmm. Everyone go see Rubble Kings. Why? Because you get to learn about these kids in the Bronx who organized for peace when there was gangs, and eventually that peace led to hip-hop. So go check that out. I don't have anything to do with the movie except I like it. Mm-hmm. But hip-hop is a culture in which kids used breakdancing, graffiti, rapping, entrepreneurship, and I'm forgetting one. But they used that to house the culture, and they said, we're going to have rap music be a part of that, we're going to have our dance be a part of that, our DJ and our graffiti be a part of that, our business, and we're going to take that culture worldwide. So rap is what I do. It's mm-hmm. the part of the culture I do, because mm-hmm. I was too chubby to break dance. So...
Although I'd never see that.
Yeah, I couldn't.
I'd pay for that.
I tried to.
Pay per view.
Best I could give
Killer
you was
Mike
away.
And break dancing, yeah.
But I ended up listening to a lot of rap from all over. Mm-hmm. And what has particularly, what stuck out like a sore thumb to me is that, you know, we're raised in a church in the South. Mm-hmm. We're raised by our grandparents. We're raised in big families. So we're raised with a sense of morale and morality that a lot of other hip hop doesn't. Now, that isn't saying it isn't good, because mm-hmm. Intellectualism is right out of mm-hmm. New York. You get it, you know, the gods, the earth, Nation of Islam influences. But in the South, you have gangster rappers that talk about God and Jesus, and it's almost Shakespearean in the tragedy that they talk mm-hmm. about crime. You get your good juke joint records, stuff like that. But for me, it was the morality in the music from the Dungeon Family, from the Ghetto Boys, you know what I mean? It was the provocative with sensibilities of the Luke and the Two Live Crew. And later, you know, even crews that you never heard of out of the South, like the guys Ghetto Mafia, who mm-hmm. were from Atlanta. So for me, man, I always wanted to be a part of that legacy. I rap good, I make dope records, but my records have a sense of morality that you might not find in other hip-hop.
To Bill O'Reilly and others who would say that it is oxymoronic to put morality and hip-hop music in the same sentence,
yeah.
you say what?
I've never hit my wife. Mm-hmm. And it's funny how Mr. O'Reilly castigates an art form because he understands it. And he understands that what he's saying is a lie. And he knows that's not the truth. He knows because he's had conversations with Ice-T. If you've had a conversation with Ice-T from 1992 forward, when he first started doing interviews, you have to walk away saying, this is one of the most intelligent men I've ever met. He made his points concise and truthful. He was all the way open and honest and forthcoming with me. He'll tell you there's some good, there's some bad. He'll give you the pros and the cons, but it's from an honest place. And if you can, after you talk to him, still say you don't see the validity in hip-hop and the good it can do, then you're a liar. And then, when you propagate that rap causes violence, and then we catch you doing something violent, your child catches you, and it comes out, then you at least should have the shame to say, I'm sorry. And I understand that real violence comes from a different place. And all of us men are capable of making that mistake and capable of doing something stupid. But to blame it on a culture that children created to have peace in their community is something that's almost evil and maniacal. And it's the real reason why I really have a problem with Mr. O'Reilly, because I don't think he believes these things. And I think he sells that fear to white America. And that fear becomes something compounded, evil, and allows people to turn their head while children are murdered in the streets.
Juxtapose for me the fact that most hip-hop music is bought overwhelmingly by white kids,
yes,
and yet in the broader culture, it is oftentimes under attack by people like Bill O'Reilly and others.
Well, I think what you're seeing is a generational disagreement in the White House, and the black kids in the yard keep getting blamed for it. It happened with jazz, happened with rock and roll, happened with funk, happened with soul music. So we expected it to happen. Mm-hmm. It's what's going to happen. But you can't argue that hip-hop rots away the moral character of kids or rots their brains and still see middle-class white kids going to college listening to hip-hop, going on to become healthy adults listening to hip-hop. You have to ask yourself, what are these black kids missing? What are we not giving them by way of services, by way of school? What are we not giving their parents by way of equal pay? What are we taking away from them, you know, when we take services from them? So for me, I think that white kids listen to hip-hop because they love the truth in it, or they love the fact that it's jamming, or they're rebelling like some kids do against their parents. But they see a value in the culture. And I think in the next 20, 30 years, you're going to see hip-hop handled a dramatically different way because these children have grown up and they know that relatively it's harmless. They've been to the clubs, they've been to the parties, they understand what's real and what's fantasy, and they have a greater capacity to think. I think old people, unfortunately, are just sold a culture of fear via the television. And I think that if more people turned the television off and got out and congregated amongst people, we wouldn't have these disagreements and misunderstandings.
I mentioned hip-hop. You mentioned the White House. No secret here that the man who occupies the Oval Office is a fan of hip-hop, or at least certain parts of it. He's bragged about the fact that he has it on his iPod. Yeah. You know, he shouted out Jay-Z and others. Has this hip-hop president done right by the hip-hop community?
I don't think any United States president has done right by poor and working class people yet. And that doesn't mean forever. That means in the 40 years I've been on Earth, I have not seen it done right. I did not see Ronald Reagan do it right. I did not see George Bush 1 do it right. Clinton is often given overdue credit, I think. I mean, credit that's unwarranted based on the fact that nonviolent drug offense numbers soared in terms of the brothers that got taken off the street. And, you know, I think our current president is par for course. Now, that isn't to take our president down. That isn't to say he's a shining beacon of hope for black men in particular, because he is. He shows you that there is no ceiling. If you conduct yourself in a way, if you put education first, trade and skill, you can maneuver your way through corporate society. We're smart enough as individuals and a collective to overcome racism. I truly believe that. But with that said, I want to see the day where someone who truly loves poor and working class people holds the Oval Office. I wish to see the day that the salt of the earth human being is the person that's first thought about in state houses and in the Oval Office. So for me, it's less about has he been a friend to hip-hop culture, and it's more about do we live in a country that is a friend to poor and working class people? Because essentially when we say hip-hop culture, that's what we're saying.
As long as Washington, assuming that you agree with my assessment, I think you agree, I'll find out, but as long as Washington is bought and bossed by big money and big business, is it possible that a friend of poor and working class people ever be in the Oval Office?
Absolutely not. You got to get money out of politics. You got to get that corporate money out. It just has to stop. It has to stop. You know, the money that the person who I think should lead Atlanta next.
Killer Mike.
Hit me with.
Run for mayor, man. Killer Mike for mayor. Kasim's term is just about up. Killer Mike for mayor. I'll come down and campaign for that.
I might one
put
day.
Your name in the hat. I'll be down
there,
man. I'll be down
there. The concert's finished first. Yeah. But I, they hit me and they asked me for money for Hillary's campaign. And I love him. If he was asking for money for his campaign, I would have sent the check before the text came through. But I couldn't do it. I just couldn't bring myself to do it.
You say by he, you mean Bill?
No. By the person, the politician I'm talking about.
I got you. Okay.
He was doing a job. He's asked for money to bring her through.
Okay.
I just couldn't. I couldn't bring myself to do it because I know how much money is going in her campaign. That money's better served with a local politician. That money's better served doing something for an after-school program. It's better served in a community guard. I couldn't bring myself to do it.
Let me ask you a question. Could you not bring yourself to do it just because you know she and Bill are going to back up a Brinks truck here in a few weeks and start unloading money everywhere?
Absolutely.
Or could you not do it because of Republic policy positions?
I don't like her positions.
Okay.
I don't like her positions.
All right.
And I haven't been fond of the Clintons in the way my community has, basically because of the unwavering support of drug laws in the 90s. Like, I didn't forget that. I didn't forget that there are men that are just coming home that were given unfair sentences. I'm unable to turn away from that and say everything's okay, because it's not.
We should unpack that for those who are trying to figure out what he means by this. When Clinton was president, he signed into law that crime bill.
Absolutely.
Where you had to get caught with 100 times more powder cocaine than crack cocaine, yeah, to get the same sentence. We all know that crack is used in the streets, cocaine is used in the suites, and so you know who went to jail.
Absolutely.
And that's Mike's point. So I just want to unpack that for those who are trying to figure out why are you bashing Clinton on the drug.
Well, and not bashing.
Yeah,
not bashing.
Yeah,
just saying this is my point of contention.
Fair enough.
Bash politics as a whole.
I didn't mean the word bash. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I know that's y'all black president.
Yeah.
And number one. But I don't, you know, I just am not a, my memory's long.
Yeah.
And I don't forgive easily.
Yeah.
And that's just something I haven't been able to forgive.
I'm glad you said that. The best thing about black people, I think, is that we are such a forgiving people. Witness what happened in Charleston, and white folk are still trying to figure out, even some black people are trying to figure out how those Negroes could be so forgiving of a killer who has at this moment at least not even repentant publicly for what he did. So one of the best things about us is that we are forgiving people.
I want to hear
your take on this. I think that cuts both ways though, because I think we also have short memories, and I think that is damaging for us sometimes when our memories are so short. Now unpack what I just said.
Yeah, I'm not.
You don't think we're forgiving, or you?
No,
think
I know we
that?
Are too okay. forgiving. You know, I know we
too
are
too forgiving.
Yeah.
Okay.
Dr. John Henry Clark said, "The African don't owe anybody anything but a whooping."
Mm-hmm.
You know, he said the African has no friends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have everyone we have dealt with on a nation's time, mm-hmm, since antiquity forward,
mm-hmm,
has at the end of the day, the sword has ended up in your back. And it's only because we're so forgiving and so all-encompassing and so trusting. And it isn't to say that you can't like other people.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't to say that you can't accept someone if they ask for you to beg their pardon, but wait for the ask. I can't forgive that quickly.
If you don't, and if we as a people don't historically forgive, then how do we live?
You live with better negotiated things than we have. Mm-hmm. What has forgiveness got you? Less farmland, unstable neighborhoods, mm-hmm, poor jobs, no economic support in terms of entrepreneurship.
But forgiveness can't just be about commerce, though.
It has to be. Why?
But it can't be.
It has to be.
If it's born of a Christology, it can't be.
Yeah, but I'm not a Christian.
Okay, that's you, though.
I got that. Yeah, all black people aren't Christians.
I got your point.
Someone asked me, well, what are you? I say, I'm whatever black people was the day before an invader came in out. Whatever God they worship.
That's what you're down with.
That's me.
Yeah, okay.
I'm with that. So what I mean is to forgive.
Right.
Or to ask reconciliation has to come with something.
Right.
Like, mama, I'm sorry I didn't rake the yard.
Right.
I got a whooping.
Yeah.
I asked for forgiveness. I still had to rake the yard.
Yeah.
You get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So if I forgive you,
yeah,
take the flag.
But by that
if
logic,
I forgive you,
yeah, okay,
take the flag down.
I got you.
If I forgive you,
I got you.
Well, this flag doesn't lead to hatred.
That's right.
He had a flag in every picture with a gun.
I get you.
As a token of goodwill.
I got you.
Take the flag down.
And I agree with you on that. And my assessment is that it shouldn't have taken all of this for the flag conversation to come down in the first place.
Hey, I'm just saying, now that we're at the forgiveness table,
I got you.
What you got? Like, when I asked my wife to forgive me,
yeah.
I got to go to Louis Vuitton.
Yeah.
I got to spend $3,000. I got to come home, hope she forgive me that day.
I ain't mad at you, Shane.
Yeah. Like, so that's what I'm saying. So what, right. why are we wrong to expect something? But let me
take a next step, though. If our brothers and sisters in South Africa, after apartheid, had taken your attitude.
They have a country.
If they had taken the attitude of John Henry Clark and not have put in place that Truth and Reconciliation Commission, Mandela's point even was that the country would have fallen apart.
Everybody who was a part of the Truth and Sit. And my mentor was Alice Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Alice Johnson was head of the Atlanta Fulton Commission on Children and Youth,
mm-hmm.
and her mentor was James Orange.
Mm-hmm.
For y'all who watch Selma, he was the guy
Love
driving
James Orange.
Yeah, I know James Orange
Love
for
him.
Real.
Love
yeah,
him.
I don't know James Orange's
yeah.
character.
Yeah.
Until he died a few years ago, I called him. I talked to his kids.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is, with all that said, with all the it was a Truth and Reconciliation Committee, everybody say, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
They cried, they hugged. Some people still went to jail.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with that, because I loved it at the time when I was a younger man, they told me about it. I thought it was beautiful. I think we need to do something like that in America.
Mm-hmm.
But after we reconcile, why don't I own any of the land?
Mm-hmm.
Why does De Beers still dominate the diamond market?
But why does it have to be either or, Mike, and not both and?
What I'm saying is we done did the and.
Yeah.
When we going to get the both? When mm-hmm. do both people get something out of the
mm-hmm.
deal? We've done the and. For the last 51 years in this country,
mm-hmm.
we've done the and. Look where we at now, because we both ain't got nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what do we own? What have you acquired in exchange for your blood, in exchange for your sacrifice, in exchange for accepting the I'm sorry? You get what I'm saying? See,
mm-hmm.
follow groups of successful people and see what they did post that. Post the forgiveness and the apology of the world. The world told the Jews of Germany, we are sorry. We ignored you. They knew they were being slaughtered.
Mm-hmm.
They knew. And afterwards, they said, we'll figure it out. We'll get you a land. We'll help you be a country. The world saw the horror of Hiroshima and Japan. And after it was done, we gave them industry. And look what they became. So all I'm saying as a black man, if you ask me for forgiveness, be prepared to give me something to keep your forgiveness in your pocket and take it to your church. Involuntary servitude
and slavery, it prohibits. We hope you've enjoyed part one of our conversation with prolific rapper Michael Killer Mike Render. Tune in next week for part two. Country's real masters, just like the Bushes, Clinton and Obama, just another talking head telling lies on teleprompters. If you don't believe the theory, then argue with this logic. Why did Reagan and Obama both go after Gaddafi? We invaded sovereign soil, going after oil. Taking countries is a hobby, paid for by the whole lobby. You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Tony Marcano is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI.